Welcome once again to the South Harbor Church Podcast. South Harbor is a part of the Harbor Churches, which exist to help people find their way back to God. This week we continue our series called Lesser Gods with a message entitled The Idol of Instant Gratification. Be sure to stick around after the message for more information about how you can become connected to the South Harbor Church community. And now, here's Pastor Tim.
And if you have a Bible, we are going to be in the book of Judges this morning. Judges chapter 10. Judges chapter 10. First, how y'all doing? Good? So, who is a Christmas before Thanksgiving person? Me too. Yeah, thank you. Yeah. The older I get, the quicker that season becomes. So I got to like expand it. So I'm for King and Country's Christmas album, Live from Phoenix, if you're interested in the music. Excellent. Anyway, if you weren't with us last week we kicked off a new series. We are calling it Lesser Gods. And essentially what we want to do for the course of, we're in week 2 of 5, is look at some really bad examples of how not to live. So I want to share with you 5 stories of things not to do, how not to live. And then the series following this series, we're going to spend 5 weeks counting down to Christmas, looking at the life of Jesus. And we say this often, but Jesus is the perfect example. We are living examples. So we want to look at the perfect example in Christ of how to live. And then the 4 weeks following that, we are going to talk about our lives and how do we live this out in a very practical, everyday wake up. How do we do this? So 5 weeks looking at some bad examples, 5 weeks looking at Christ and his example, and then 4 weeks kind of talking very, very practical. That said, this morning's passage is hard. So I want to share with you a story, what not to do. And honestly, this one is one of the most troubling stories in the entire Bible. And I think you're going to agree with me when we read it. That's a hard one, if I'm honest. This one, as I was doing the work on this message, I read the story, then you try to do the context work, like where did this happen, what was happening here, and then you do your best to say, okay, God, would you put me in the story, help me to feel what this would have felt like to those who lived this originally, like help me to feel it, what are you trying to say to me in this? And honestly, with this story, there were times where I was putting the message together that I had to purposefully not put myself in the story because it was so disgusting to me that even to think about it was just disgusting. And I think you're going to agree when we read it. But that said, this story is in the scriptures. It has been passed down from faith community after faith community throughout the generations. It has been passed down for a reason. The story has endured for a reason. God has put this story in his book for a reason. And this particular story of this particular person we're going to look at takes up 3 chapters in our Bible. That's a lot of real estate for a really pretty ugly story. It's a lot of real estate. So there's something here. There's some reason this story has endured. And what I've been wrestling with trying to put this together is why did it endure and what is it God would speak to us through this particular story? So before we get in, let me just give a little bit of context on what we're going to be looking at. The story takes place in a book called Judges. We call it Judges because this story happens between kind of 2 major events. The Exodus event, where the Israelites leave Egypt, where they were slaves and travel 40 years in the desert and enter the Promised Land. So this story is after that, and it's before the kingdom, the monarchy, the kings, the United Nation of Israel. So it's between that story and the kingdom. This particular moment is when the Israelite people were led by a group of military generals that they called judges. I know we think judge and we think gavel and black. We think Judy, right? We hear judge, we think Judy. Don't think Judy, think Patton. Military general, military commander. I got somebody who was saying, I used the example last week of a Marine. So I think, and he's like, I was in the Army. Okay, Army, whatever. Picture tough, strong military generals, both men and women. Deborah's in here too. So think military generals when we read the Judges. The military general we're going to look at this morning is a guy by the name of Jephthah. Now, Jephthah's story begins in chapter 10, but Jephthah's not really mentioned until chapter 11. Chapter 10 is some backstory. And so what I want to do is I want to walk you through the backstory because it's really important to understand Jephthah and why he does what he does. And I just want to name it on the front end. It's a bit complex. And so I'm going to do my best to to give you the details and kind of work through the details of the story, but it's a bit complex. There's a lot of working pieces. So see if you can stay with me for like 10 minutes of brutal history, and then hopefully it'll help the story come to life a little bit. So if you have a Bible, let's read it together. Judges 10, verse 6. It says this. Again, the Israelites did evil in the eyes of the Lord. I'm going to pause there already. What you discover in the book of Judges is there's this pattern. The Israelite people follow God, and God is with them in some beautiful ways. And then life gets pretty comfortable, and they find themselves bowing down to the gods of the region, the world where they live. And God will say, okay, if you want them to be your God, okay, I'll back off. And life falls apart. And then they cry out to God, and God steps back in. And then they get comfortable, and they forget about God, and life falls apart. I mean, it's this pattern. After the first service, somebody came to me and was like, that's actually the pattern of my life. I things are going really badly, and I cry out to God, and he always answers me, and then I get comfortable, and I fall away from that, and I find myself bowing down to the wrong things. So that's what's going on in the story. Again, the Israelites did evil in the eyes of the Lord. They served the Baals and the Ashtoreths. It's like the male and the female god of the Canaanite people. And the gods of Aram, the gods of Sidon, the gods of Moab, the gods of the Ammonites, and the gods of the Philistines. Okay, let me show you a map. Who are we talking about here? There's few things that give me greater joy than showing people maps of Israel. Last week, we had our pre-Israel trip meeting, and I spent an hour. I didn't realize I was talking as much as I did. I spent an hour just pointing out things on maps. So who are the people we're talking about? So the Ammonites are there here. This is Israel. That's Sea of Galilee, Dead Sea, Jordan River. This is the Ammonites who are mentioned. Then we have Sidon, Tyre and Sidon. That Jesus meets a Syrophoenician woman, and she's from this area. So she's up north here. They're bowing down to these gods. They're bowing down to the gods of Philistines. Let's see, I'm reading Philistia. Yeah. There you go. They're here. So the Philistines are sea people. We believe they came from Greece. They came in and they settled this land. It's really good land. They controlled the major road here for a while. But the Israelites at this time are bowing down to these gods. They're bowing down to the gods of Moab. See how well you know your Bible. Anybody know the story that takes place or who's from Moab? Ruth. So Ruth is here. This is a mountain range right here. And Ruth is from here, and she comes to Bethlehem, and that's where that story happens. They're bowing down to these gods. Who did I miss? The Amorites are here. Aram is up here. They're basically what the beginning of the story says. Judges chapter 10 is the Israelite people did evil in the eyes of the Lord, and they're bowing down to all of them. All around them, there are gods, and they're bowing down. They're just kind of picking whatever god's the closest, and they're bowing down to that god, offering sacrifices to that god. They're bowing down to all of the gods. Back to the story. And because the Israelites forsook the Lord and no longer served him, he became angry with them. He sold them into the hands of the Philistines, and the Ammonites, who that year shattered and crushed them. Now, again, the Philistines are over here, and the Ammonites are over here. So what we have in this story is they're being squeezed by two empires are squeezing the Israelites. And the next verse will say that this squeezing is going to happen for 18 years. Now, in particular, our story is going to involve the Ammonites who are here. When the Israelites come out of slavery in Egypt, they come up and around, and there are 12 tribes, and they cross into the promise, what was referred to as the promised land. However, 2.5 tribes, the tribe of Gad, Reuben, and half the tribe of Manasseh, settle east of the Jordan in this area. They refer to this area as Gilead. What we have here is the Ammonites are saying, we want this land. You are in our land. We want that land. And so, especially the Jabbok River, anybody know the story that happens at the Jabbok River? Jacob wrestles with God. He gets named Israel. That happens here at the Jabbok River. This is a really a great wadi. It's you can grow really good food here. So they want this land. This is like desert. We don't want this. We want this land. This land is good land. And so for 18 years, both sides are squeezing the Israelites. But the people of Gilead, where our story is going to take place, are getting squeezed by the Ammonites. Make sense? For some background. Now, what is going to happen, 18 years of this happening, is the elders of Gilead, this area, come together and they call a meeting because these Ammonites are pressuring us. We need to figure out what to do with these Ammonites. So they call a meeting, and the meeting's going to take place here at a city called Mizpah. If you have a Bible, turn with me to look with me at verse 17. When the Ammonites were called to arms and camped at Gilead, the Israelites assembled and camped at Mizpah. The leaders of the people of Gilead said to each other, "Whoever will take the lead in attacking the Ammonites will be head over all who live in Gilead." So the leaders come together and they realize, we have a problem. And it's not just the Ammonites. The Ammonites are a problem, but we have a bigger problem. No one is able to lead us. No one's willing to lead us. These people are too strong. They're too tough. We've looked around. No one will lead us. They call a meeting and they realize, no one's here. Now, if we could find somebody, they say, we will appoint that person to be our leader, not just over us in a military effort, but leader over us as like the whole territory, like a king, like a judge. Which brings us to chapter 11 and a guy by the name of Jephthah. Verse 1. See, that was the background. Is it? We still okay? Brutal history, but you're with me? Okay. Verse 1. Jephthah, the Gileadite, was a mighty warrior. His father was Gilead. His mother was a prostitute. Pause there. Immediately, our author wants us to know some background information on Jephthah. Jephthah, he's a mighty warrior. That's the first detail we're given. But then we're told some things about his parents. His dad was Gilead. His dad, it's assumed by the author, by name-dropping Gilead, you would know who Gilead is. If you grew up in this region, Gilead was a pretty big deal. Gilead is a Jew. Gilead's Israelite. Gilead is a man of integrity. In fact, he's named after the region. That's his dad. But then we're told something about his mom. His mom is a prostitute. Read between the lines, Jephthah is a social outcast. Jephthah is an accident. Jephthah is a, oops, didn't mean to get caught there. Jephthah is an oops. Verse 2. Gilead's wife also bore him sons. So Gilead, man of like standing in the community, Gilead has a kid with a prostitute, and Gilead is married. Jephthah is not only a social outcast because he's the son of a prostitute. Jephthah is a social outcast because he's the product of an affair. And not just any affair, an affair with a prostitute. Gilead's wife also bore him sons. And when they were grown up, they drove Jephthah away. "You are not going to get any inheritance in our family," they said, "because you are the son of another woman." So Jephthah fled from his brothers and settled in the land of Tob, where a gang, Tob, by the way, is... we don't really know. We think it's probably up in this area. Some people place it over here. We don't know exactly, but it's probably... he leaves his land and he moves north. This area is his land. He moves north. So Jephthah fled from his brothers and settled in the land of Tob, where a gang of scoundrels gathered around him and followed him. So Jephthah's half-brothers, so same dad, but they have a mom. Their mom is a mom of standing, too. Jephthah's half-brothers look at Jephthah and think, "You are a black stain on our family. You are, every time we're in the street and people see you, they ask these questions. You don't look like us. Where did this kid come from?" And every single time, we have got to explain to people what our dad did. "You have made our whole family a disgrace. You are a reminder of what has happened, and we don't want you here anymore." And so Jephthah is forced to leave his family and his land. Now, if you've been coming to South for a while, we've talked about how important family and land are in the scriptures. If you grew up in the ancient Middle East, there is nothing more important than family and land. If one of those two things were taken away from you, you would rather be dead. truthfully, you would welcome death than to lose your family or your land. They were your legacy. And what we read here is Jephthah is forced to leave both. He's an outcast. And as an outcast, he finds himself leading a gang of scoundrels. He's angry, and his anger is spilling out, spilling sideways. He's leading a gang of... Now, this is going to be a detail that is going to matter for those elders who are gathered at Mitzpah. Remember, they're gathered, and they're trying to figure out who's going to lead us against the Ammonites. We have this guy named Jephthah. Jephthah is, like, he's an outcast. He's a blemish on the people, and he's also got an ability to lead. People follow him. Now, his anger's spilling sideways, but when he speaks, when he leads, people follow Jephthah. Verse 4. Sometime later, when the Ammonites were fighting against Israel, the elders of Gilead went to get Jephthah from the land of Tob. Come, they said, be our commander so we can fight the Ammonites. Jephthah said to them, didn't you hate me and drive me from my father's house? Why do you come to me now when you're in trouble? You can feel his anger, right? Oh, you're going to come to me now? Really? Now you want something from me. Before, where were you when my brothers drove me out of my house? You were helping them get rid of me. You were helping them. You weren't stopping them. Where were you when I needed someone to defend me? I didn't do anything wrong. It was my dad who did the... Where were you then? I was forced to figure it out on my own. You feel his anger in the story. The elders of Gilead said to him, okay, nevertheless, we are turning to you now. Come with us to fight the Ammonites, and you will be head over all of us who live in Gilead. Jephthah answered, suppose you take me back to fight the Ammonites, and the Lord gives them to me. Will I really be your head? In other words, prove it. Prove it. The elders of Gilead replied, because you know what he's thinking. Like, I'm going to give you this victory, and then you're going to have, well, we're going to take care of the Ammonites, and then you're going to be like, okay, bye-bye, Jephthah. We don't want you anymore. You did your job. You served your role. We're done with you. So he's like, prove that I'll be your head. The elders of Gilead replied, the Lord is our witness. We will certainly do as you say. So Jephthah went away and went with the elders of Gilead, and the people made him head and commander over them. So, and he repeated all his words before the Lord, Yahweh, in Mitzpah. So he makes a vow before God. Now, the elders say, we need you. Jephthah says, oh, now you need me. They say, please, come, lead us. If you lead us, we'll make you our head. Jephthah says, prove it. They say, okay, come with us now. We'll appoint you to essentially be our king, our judge, pre-kings, but we'll let you be our judge now before you do anything. We'll let you lead us now. You will come back into the land. You will have a new family in the land again. We will restore you now. So Jephthah is now the judge, and Jephthah's got to deal with the Ammonites. That's his job, because if he doesn't deal with the Ammonites, that's why they want him. So his first attempt at dealing with the Ammonites is he's going to try something that you probably wouldn't guess just by looking at the character of Jephthah. He tries diplomacy. He goes to the king of Ammon, and he says to the king, essentially, hey, can we talk this out? Can we work through this? It's been 18 years of you constantly doing this. It's not good for your people. It's not good for my people. Can we figure this out? Verse 12. Then Jephthah sent messengers to the Ammonite king with a question. What do you have against me that you have attacked my country? The king of the Ammonites answered Jephthah's messengers. When Israel came up out of Egypt, they took away my land from the Arnon to the Jabbok, the two rivers on the map, all the way to the Jordan. Now give it back peaceably. By the way, so his request is like, hey, wait, you guys came in and you took out our land. You don't have a right to tell me to give it back. You took it from us, which, by the way, isn't true. If you read the story, it's in Numbers 21 where they take the land. They don't take this land. The king of the Ammonites has got it wrong, which we'll skip this part, but verses 14 through 28 is a really lengthy, very king-like speech back to the king of Ammon saying, no, you got it wrong. You got your details wrong. It didn't happen like this. So he tries diplomacy, and then in verse 29, after the speech, verse 28, the king of Ammon, however, paid no attention to the message Jephthah sent him. So diplomacy fails. Now what are you going to do? Got to fight. So Verse 29, then the Spirit of the Lord came on Jephthah. He crossed Gilead and Manasseh, passed through Mizpah of Gilead, and from there he advanced against the Ammonites. Now, to recap, we're about to the heart of our story. To recap, you feel a little bit bad for Jephthah, do you not? Up until this point, Jephthah isn't an oops. He's an accident. He's a black stain on the family. Jephthah, up until this point, he gets kicked out of his family. He gets kicked out of his land. He has to go figure it out on his own. You feel bad for Jephthah. He finds a gang. That's all he's got, is he finds some people that will eventually like help him survive in the world, but he's got no one. And now, overnight, Jephthah has got the love of the people. You can lead us. And Jephthah has the Spirit of God rest on him. Jephthah, overnight, life has turned for Jephthah. Which makes the next piece kind of odd. Verse 30. And Jephthah made a vow to the Lord. Why do you need to make a vow if you already have God with you? Jephthah makes a vow to the Lord. If you give the Ammonites into my hands, whatever comes out of the door of my house to meet me when I return in triumph from the Ammonites will be the Lord's, Yahweh's. And I will sacrifice it as a burnt offering. So Jephthah makes a vow. It's an if-then kind of vow. If you give me the victory, then I'll give you whatever comes out of my house first as a sacrifice. I'll light it on fire. It'll be yours, God. I'll show you my devotion to you by lighting whatever comes out of the door of my house first. I'll give it as a sacrifice to you. If you give me, ever feel desperate? Ever find yourself, maybe when you were younger, maybe now, ever find yourself making an if-then to God? I remember vivid memories when I was in my mid-20s, laying in bed, lonely, and saying to God, like, God, if you give me a wife, I'll give you my life, whatever that would look like. But if you'll do this, I'm desperate. God, would you do that? If you'll do this, God, then I'll do this. This is what Jephthah's saying. Now, Jephthah doesn't need to make a vow. He's already got the presence of the Lord. He doesn't need to make this. God doesn't ask him to make this promise. In fact, later, almost certainly, Jesus will point back to this story as a way of saying, like, hey, let your yes be yes and your no be no. Don't make a vow before God. You don't need to make a vow before. Just let your yes be yes and your no be no. God knows your heart. Now, he says, okay, if you give me, here's his vow. If you give me the victory, I'll give you the first thing out of my house. Now, here's most likely the assumption Jephthah's working under. Let me show you a picture of a house. It's a pile of rocks, but it's ruins. See if you can imagine. This is a house from the region. It's a four-bedroom house. The word in Hebrew for it, the first thing to come out of my house, the word for house there is the word bayit. Bayit is a specific kind of house, a four-bedroom house that would look something like this. In the back, you have a four bedrooms. So in the back bedroom is the bedroom of mom and dad, matriarch and patriarch of the family. Then in front of that bedroom, you have a bedroom for the rest of the family. And then to the side of that bedroom, also to the front of mom and dad's bedroom, you have a bedroom for the guests. This is a culture of hospitality. So you keep a room open for the guests, a guest room. Then in the front, a long, thin, narrow room. That would be the space where if you had money, you'd put your slaves would go there. Which, by the way, Jephthah probably, now he's got some power, so he may have some slaves. But most likely, he's probably not very wealthy right now yet. So probably doesn't have any slaves. So you put your slaves in the front room, or you'd put your animals. Remember, animals are your possessions. They are your Lexus. They are your Silverado, whatever. Like that, you put your treasured possessions. And like any animals, when they're cooped up for too long, you go away, you lock your animals up so nobody steals them, nobody takes them, nobody kills them. You open the door. I have a black lab, and I open the door, and he goes barreling out. So the assumption most likely from Jephthah is when I come back, my best animal is going to run out of that house. The one who wants it the best, the most. He's going to run out of the house. And God, I'll give him to you. Small price to pay for a victory. My best animal, God, will be yours. I'll show you how devoted I am to you. I'll give you my best. That's probably the assumption. Verse 32. Then Jephthah went over to fight the Ammonites, and the Lord gave them into his hands. The Lord gave them into his hands. He devastated 20 towns from Aroer to the vicinity of Minnith, as far as Abel Keramim. Thus Israel subdued Ammon 18 years, and finally they win. When Jephthah returned to his home in Mizpah, who should come out to meet him? An animal? Slave? But his daughter, dancing to the sound of timbrels. She was an only child. Except for her, he had neither son nor daughter. See how it's like, I didn't even want to think about this story. And when he saw her, he tore his clothes and he cried, "Oh no, my daughter. You have brought me down, and I am devastated. I have made a vow to the Lord that I cannot break." By the way, he's wrong, you realize, right? There's nothing more detestable to God. God himself says this 12 times in the Old Testament. There's nothing more detestable to God, more disgusting, more despicable than child sacrifice. I know all the other gods from Canaan, all the gods that they worship. I know all of them demand it. But not me, God says. Never, ever. I don't care how many people you promise. Never, ever. Now you're thinking, what about Abraham and Isaac and the binding of Isaac? We did a whole couple of sermons on that story. I think God sets the whole story in motion so that he can wake Abraham up and say, from now on, never. I'm not like that. I don't demand that. I'll take you out for coffee. We'll talk about it if you're interested. But he's wrong. God never demands it. Not here, not later. God doesn't demand. How you view God matters. We talk about this a lot here. But if God is the kind of God that would demand the life of a child, that God is a monster. Jephthah's view of God looks a lot more like the gods of the Ammonites than the God of Israel. Verse 34, when Jephthah returned to his home in Mizpah, who should come out to meet him but his daughter, dancing to the sound of timbrels? She was an only child. Except for her, he had neither son nor daughter. When he saw her, he tore his clothes and he cried, "Oh no, my daughter, you have brought me down and I am devastated. I have made a vow to the Lord that I cannot break." "My father," she replied, "you have given your word to the Lord. Do to me just as you promised, now that the Lord has avenged you of your enemies, the Ammonites. But grant me this one request," she said. "Give me 2 months to roam the hills and weep with my friends because I will never marry." "You may go," he said, and he let her go for 2 months. She and her friends went to the hills and they wept because she would never marry. After the 2 months, she returned to her father and he did to her as he had vowed. And she was a virgin. And that's the story. That's what we get. He assumes, most likely, that an animal is going to come out of his house. But it's not an animal. It's his only daughter. That's the story. We read that ends with, "She's a virgin. She's a virgin." Three times it's, "She will never marry. She'll never marry. She'll never marry. She's a virgin." Why that detail? Well, the average marriage age around this time was around 12 or 13 years old. As soon as a female could get pregnant, they would marry her off. And so most likely this little girl is a little girl. She's probably 10, 11, 12 years old. I mean, can you picture the scene? Like, it's daddy's been gone. Daddy comes home. She's been waiting. She'll beat the best animals out. She'll get out of the door first, and she comes running out with instruments and dancing. And then dad falls on his face, and he begins crying, "You've devastated me, daughter." How confused must she have been? What a horrible story. What a horrible, horrible, horrible story. Am I right? This one makes you kind of sick. So this past Halloween, I don't know if you guys went trick-or-treating. It's a weird left turn, but follow me. So we went trick-or-treating. My son was Mario, only he says Mario. He says it right, Mario. So he was Mario. My daughter was Elsa. And And so the three of us went out. Liza stayed back with my youngest because she's too young to know what's going on, and it was freezing outside. There were snowflakes that were like the size of little kittens or something coming down. And my son met up with my son's cousins, and my son and his cousin went running ahead, and their dad went with him. My brother-in-law went with them, and I went running ahead. And then it was me and Joanna, little Elsa, and we went together. So just the two of us. And her dress was just a little bit too long, and it was dragging a bunch of twigs and sticks and stuff because it was all this lacy stuff. And so like we had to like, I had to help her like hold it up like this. And so she had her basket on one hand, and she was walking with her dress on the other. And cutest little girl. And we would go to the houses, and she would... So I would stay back with the dads, you know, like you kind of wait on the side of the, and talk to the neighborhood dads, and she would run up to the house and say the trick or treat, and then she would turn every single time. She would turn and she would say, "I got candy," every single time. I'm like, I don't know what you thought was going to happen, but yes, they give you candy. That's like the whole premise. And so every single time, like house after house after house, and just by the end of the night, like she finally, I'm like, "Are you cold? Are you cold?" You know, we try to like bundle her up, but she's got this dress on, and she's like, "No, no, no." And then at the end, she's just like, "I'm cold, Dad." And so I carry her home, and I cannot put myself and my family in this story. I cannot fathom as a dad how Jephthah does what Jephthah does. I cannot fathom it. Do not get it. Don't understand it. Cannot justify it. My wife and I took a vacation. It was amazing. We got just the two of us. It was good for the soul. It was good for our marriage just a couple weeks ago. And it was like four or five. Liza says to me, this is the first time she had taken a vacation away from the kids for this length of time. And she said, "I feel physically, I miss them so much. It's like I feel physically sick." I cannot fathom how a dad does this. What an ugly story. And by the way, maybe you heard the tradition that he doesn't actually go through with it, that he dedicates his daughter in the temple and she lives the rest of her life in the temple. That tradition starts 2,500 years after this story. It's a new tradition. In fact, the temple doesn't even exist yet. I understand why the tradition was created, because this story as it sits in our Bible is hard to deal with. But the idea of a burnt offering is mentioned a lot in the Old Testament, and every single time it's literal. It's never a metaphor. Later in the New Testament, we'll talk about offer yourself as a living sacrifice. There it's metaphor. Here it's not metaphor. Jephthah says, "First thing to come out of my house, I'll offer to you, God, as a burnt offering," and that's what happened. And by the way, just in case you think, like, this is why I don't do church. God is a monster. God is a monster. Why would God even allow? Just understand that then and now, there is no leader in Israel's history that gets more like, what an awful leader to the rabbis than Jephthah. He's like the worst of the worst. In fact, the last detail we're given of Jephthah, Judges 12, verse 7. Jephthah led Israel 6 years. Then Jephthah the Gileadite died and was buried in a town in Gilead. What the rabbis recognize is the word town there is plural. Now our translators realize, okay, you can't be buried in multiple towns. But the rabbis say, of course you can. If you're as bad as Jephthah, you can. And they tell a story about Jephthah. It's probably not true, but it gets at how they felt about Jephthah. The story goes, Jephthah, after he offers his daughter, Jephthah wanders from town to town. And every town he goes to, another limb falls off. And so he's buried in multiple towns until he's left a stump. Because that's what happens when you do what Jephthah did. You become a stump of a human being. That's the story they tell. Why is this story in our Bible? Why is this story endured? Why? By the way, Jephthah rules only 6 years. 6 years. He's easily the shortest of all the judges to rule. He leads the least amount of time. And he's third for the real estate in the Bible. Around the judges. He, second to Samson and Gideon, he leads longer than the others. More real, why would he get so much? And as I sat with this story and thought about this particular story, and I think I get it. I think the story of Jephthah is in our Bible because I think our spiritual ancestors have passed this story down from generation after generation after generation, because this story is a warning. And if I look at my life and I think our culture, our world right now, this warning is a warning we probably need to pay attention to, maybe now more than ever. The warning is this: if we're not careful, we can live such short-sighted, short views of our world, of our life. We can cease to have a long-range view of our life. And if we're not careful, we can find ourselves sacrificing our future, sacrificing tomorrow on the altar of today, on immediate gratification, on immediate glory, immediate success, immediate achievement. If we're not careful, we can sacrifice tomorrow on the altar of today. In the 1970s, a physician and professor named Gabe Merkin conducted an informal poll. He asked aspiring runners who were going to the Olympics that he gave them this proposition. He said, "Hey, if I could give you a pill, and this pill would help you win the Olympics, gold medal in the Olympics, but the flip side of the pill is you would die within a year, would you take the pill?" Now, that was an informal poll. Later, a guy by the name of Bob Goldman set out to see if the results would line up, if this was more provable, like if more people would respond this way. We refer to it as Goldman's dilemma. Here's the question he asked. He said, "If I had a magic drug that was so fantastic that if you took it once, you would win every competition you would enter, from the Olympic decathlon to Mr. Universe, for the next 5 years. But it had one minor drawback. It would kill you 5 years after you took it. Would you still take the drug?" Here's the results. More than 50% in both studies said, "Absolutely, I would." Now you're thinking, that's crazy. Yeah, it is crazy. It's crazy. And I don't think we would do that. I really don't. I think there's a certain kind of mindset around an athlete that often they would, but I don't think. And I would never, ever, 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 ever suggest that you would ever, ever do what Jephthah did. Ever. Especially, never. I don't think that. I do think, though, that the warning of Jephthah, I think it endures. That I think in much more subtle ways, if we're not careful, we can find ourselves sacrificing tomorrow for immediate success on the altar of today. Let me just give a couple examples. When I was a freshman in college, I went to Hope College. Who went to Hope College? Yes. Calvin University. Come on. Who are you trying to impress? Who went to Calvin? Who went to Calvin College? Anyone at Calvin University in the current? Okay. Oh, yeah. Okay. There we go. Nice. I think. We love you too. There's room. So at Hope College, there is a park in the center of college. We call it the Pine Grove, and it's the center of kind of campus life. You play frisbee golf there, yeah, whatever. You hang out in the Pine Grove. If the weather's nice, a lot of the students are just kind of hanging out there, skipping class or whatever you do, hanging out in the Pine Grove. And my freshman year, kind of right around this time, a little bit earlier, like late fall, early winter, but it was gorgeous outside, kind of like yesterday, beautiful day. And I remember I was running late for class, but I remember running through the Pine Grove and realizing that there was a table set up in the middle of the Pine Grove, and the really nice people behind the table were handing out free pizza. Only one small catch. You had to fill out a form for a credit card, but then they would just give you the pizza. And few things are more enticing to a college freshman than free hot pizza. Am I right? You're like a king for a day if you bring that back to the dorm room. There's few things more enticing. Thankfully, I was late for class and didn't sign the paper. If I'm honest, I bet that there are some people that are still paying off that pizza, right? I bet that there are some people that took out the credit card and thought, "I'll never use this," but then they're running out of money and they really want to go on that date and they want to impress her, so they pull out the credit card and they pull out the credit card. And the numbers of debt in our country is staggering. The individual debt, every time Dave Ramsey class is offered and we see how much money is saved in debt, is astounding, and it should wake us up a bit. And it's good things too, right? Last week we talked to the Tim Keller quote about how an idol is often a good thing that becomes ultimate. It's not a bad thing, It's a good thing, but it's a thing like a pizza or a car or whatever it is. And we find ourselves in a spot where we can't climb out of it. It owns us. How about work? This one is, I mean, again, so here's the thing. Often our motives are good, right? I don't, like, often our motives are really, really pure and really, really good. We'll even say things like, I'm just sacrificing for my family. Like, I'm just sacrificing for my family. Like, it's, this is, I'm gonna work a little extra now, put a little more time in now so that someday we have more time together. And so I'm just sacrificing for my family. And yet we miss things, right? I know I've been guilty of this. We miss things. And we're not home by dinner. We're not. And what can happen is in our attempts to sacrifice for our family, we can find ourselves accidentally sacrificing from our family. I get the privilege of getting woken up by some of you who are older and will remind me that life is short and that the illusion, some of you who are older, affirm this, the illusion that if I work hard now that I'll have more time later, is it an illusion? Does work ever slow down? Some jobs potentially, but for most of us, like you work and it just speeds up. And so we have to force the brakes if we want to make sure that we don't sacrifice tomorrow on the altar of today. We have to. And again, it's good, but you have to be careful. If you're dating, listen up for just a moment. If you're dating, whether we are aware of it when we're dating or not, whether you're aware of it or not, the decisions you make when you're dating do have long-term consequences. And every one of us who is older can say, yeah, we've seen that, either in our own lives or in the lives of people close to us. We've seen it. Our choices in dating have long-term consequences. If he or she is pressuring you to do things that violate your values, they're your values. You decided you want these values. You want to live this way. You've held this as your highest goal in life. If he or she is pressuring you to violate those values, he or she is not worth sacrificing your future for. Now, you don't got to judge them. You can still love them, but you don't have to date them. What I'm asking is that we would, especially those of you who are young or dating, like have long-range views of your relationships, not just what's good for today. I know it like flies. You want to be truly rebellious, okay? Truly a true rebel, because it's going to fly in the face of a YOLO culture. Is YOLO still a thing? I don't know if it is or not, but it's going to fly in the face of a YOLO culture. It's going to the you be you culture, you do you, the swipe right. Like, it's going to fly in the face of it. But to have a long range like vision of your relationship, if he or she is pressuring you now. I have a 5-year-old, almost 6. He'll say 5 3/4. Okay, so 5 3/4. A 3-year-old is almost 4, and a 1-year-old. And when they want something that they can't have, especially the 3 and the 1, they will throw fits and they'll throw tantrums to try to get their way. If he or she that you're dating is throwing a fit because they're not getting their way, they're a child. They're a little boy. And to expect that child is going to someday become a man maybe will happen, but it's not worth waiting for if he's not there now. Love him, pray for him, don't judge him, all that, but you don't have to stay in that relationship. If she or he is so obsessed with like how they look to the world, how beautiful they are, that they can't see anyone else, if they treat the waiter or the waitress, like if they don't treat them with kindness and love, then they probably aren't the person you want to bring children into the world with someday. Now you're thinking, wow, that's way away. I'm not even like, whoa, I'm not even close to that. Okay, probably, good. Your parents are happy for that. But don't miss out on a potential good thing because you're in this thing that you know isn't made to last. Don't sacrifice tomorrow on the altar of today. Don't sacrifice tomorrow on the altar of today. And this is true for all areas of life. I won't give you... I'm going to give a couple more examples. Food, how you eat matters, right? How you eat matters. I know kale's disgusting. I'm not saying eat kale, okay? That's disgusting. But maybe some spinach. But how you eat now will affect how you feel later. It's just true. Stretching, how you stretch now will affect later. It just affects you. How you how you sleep now. There's a season where you can pull off the 5 hours a night, that will catch up with all of us. It'll catch up with all of us. Do not sacrifice tomorrow on the altar of today. Getting more done today. I was at the gym a couple weeks ago, and there was this guy, and he's lifting, and I'm like, he's doing this, right? Ryan, that's not good for your back, is it? It's not good for your back. He's doing this, and I'm just watching him do this, and I'm like, I must have had that look on my face of like, I'm judging him. I wasn't trying, but I was like, what is going on? And this, because this older guy next to me says, youth, it's wasted on the young. That's just awesome. What a great quote. And then he says, yeah, he probably won't pay for that now, but he'll cash that check sometime around 40. And I'm like, yeah, probably. I mean, he's probably right. What you do now affects, like, have a long view of your life. Have a long-term vision of your life. That's the invitation of Jephthah. Have a long-term vision. What you'll see when we dive into Jesus, specific practices of Jesus, is Jesus had a long view of things. He'll often retreat because he needs to recharge. Jesus will often do things that fly in the face of culture because it's important to do those things. He has a long view. He chooses patience. You know, the first characteristic of love in the, you know, the love poem of 1 Corinthians 13 is patience, like slowing down, being patient. Love is patience. Jesus chooses patience and goodness. I was reading an article about Mr. Rogers that just came out. I shared it. It's a half an hour read, but it's totally worth it. I shared it on Facebook. It's from The Atlantic. But like what everyone is so worked up on is, why can't we find any negative on Mr. Rogers? It has to be too good to be true. And this author meets him, like he's going to try to prove that Mr. Rogers was not who he said he was. And what he discovers was, no, he's Mr. Rogers all around. And he goes, what is so compelling about Mr. Rogers is also the very thing we don't want to do. We want to look up to him. We want to admire him, but we don't actually want to do what he did. And man, oh man, does that sound like a description of Jesus, doesn't it? We look up to him. We want to revere him. We'll worship him even. But to actually live like he lived, forgive my enemies? No. Turn the other. No, I don't want. The invitation, the warning of Jephthah is, if we live with a short view of our world, we will find ourselves with limbs falling off all over the place. But the warning of Jephthah is, we can choose to live another way. We're going to end with communion this morning. And communion is an ancient practice that goes back to the night Jesus was betrayed. And that night, Jesus gathered with his friends for what they thought was just going to be a Passover celebration, but Jesus flips it a bit, and he gathers with his friends, and he says, hey, every time you do this, now we're not sure if he meant this as in celebrate Passover, or if he meant this as in communion, like we're doing today, or if he meant this as in every time you eat. We're not sure. He leaves it up to us a little bit. Like, we don't know. But he says, every time you do this in remembrance of me. This is how you are to enact. Paul later will say, whether we eat or drink, we do it all for the glory of God. So every time we eat or drink, it's a way for us to say the little things, from the little things to the big things, it's all part of our view of God. It's all part of our worship of God. And so what we want to do to end this morning is we're going to do this as a church family, and we're going to take the bread and we'll dip it in the juice. You'll take a little piece of bread and dip it in the juice. And allow this to be your act of rebellion against a world of immediate gratification. Allow this to be your act of surrender to say, Jesus, I am yours. And not just, Jesus, I worship you and I serve you as my Lord. And that means that you get to call the shots for how I live. All of it. Some details. We've got 5 stations. The 2 on the ends have a gluten-free option. They have both options, but one of them is gluten-free. And then the rest of them all have, or all of them have regular bread and juice. And then Denise, raise your hand real high. There's Denise. Denise will be wandering around, making her way around the room. If you're unable to make it to the front, she would love to serve you in your seat and take her up on that. She's fantastic. She'll take communion with you. And but for everyone else, like, you'll be welcome to the table. Like, if you're a follower of Jesus, we want to invite, we're going to do this together. But before we do, would you join me in a word of prayer? Jesus, we thank you that we are able to look at Jephthah and we are all able to agree that this story is awful. And Jesus, what we recognize is for so many in the ancient world, Lord, they looked at this story as normal. This is just what the gods required. Jesus, we thank you that you've shown us your true self. God, we thank you that you've shown us that you're not a God. As you say, Lord, you demand mercy, not sacrifice. Lord, we thank you that you're a God who has woken us up to goodness and life and beauty. And Jesus, we turn it all back to you as an act of worship. As we take communion this morning, Lord, I pray especially for those in this space who are brokenhearted. Lord, I pray that you in this moment would whisper to them and speak to them. As we sing, Great is thy faithfulness, in a moment, Lord, would you remind them that even in the dark days where we can't see you, God, you are faithful. And if we cry out, God, you do hear us. Lord, I pray for those in the space who have big decisions in front of them. There's a decision about work. There's a decision about a dating relationship. There's a decision about a habit that's gone a little bit out of control. Lord, I pray for those in the space that have a decision in front of them that in this moment, Lord, you would make more clear what might be unclear for them at this point. But ultimately, Lord, we thank you that we get to do this together. Lord, what a gift. And so, Jesus, we pray this in your name.
Well, thanks for listening. We hope today's message was both a challenge and a blessing. For more information about the South Harbor Church community, visit us on the web at www.southharbor.org, or you can connect with us on social media on Facebook and Instagram at South Harbor Church. If you're in the West Michigan area, we hold our Sunday services at 9 and 11, and we'd love to see you there. So until next time, we hope you have a great week.